Dargraith Publishing presents The Heartland Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in economics and business. This is Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 101 for summer semester 2014. Lecture 12, delivered on July 15, 2014. The title of this lecture is Income, Poverty, and Economic Prosperity.
Tonight, Income, Poverty, and Economic Prosperity. This lecture is relatively brief. However, it does encompass some important transitional material taking you from microeconomics to macroeconomics. The context, bear with me, need that down for the slides that I'm going to show you later. I will caution you that towards the end of this section, in this first part of the class, there will be some imagery that is somewhat disturbing. Welcome to college. But the first thing that I want to bring up is the idea of economic prosperity. More to the point, how do we measure how we are doing as a country? And how do we measure how we're doing against other countries? There are some traditional ways to do it. They all have something that they are useful for, but they are all flawed because none of them tell the whole story from beginning to end. So you have to take each one in its sort of in its context. The easiest one to get your hands on for almost any country in the world, almost any country, is, and what we're doing here is saying measurement. So the first thing that we want to talk about with economic prosperity is the measurements that are available to us. Again, pretty much the most readily available is GDP, gross domestic product. Gross domestic product. Now, I'm going to give you a definition of GDP. You don't have to write it down too fast because it'll be in the PowerPoint that you have for this lecture. But gross domestic product measures the value of all newly produced goods and services. And these are those that are produced within the borders of the country. The value of all newly produced, and I might have left out a word there, final goods and services made within the borders of a country. Now, let me emphasize a couple of things about that definition. First thing, newly produced. So in other words, we don't include used goods transactions, because they were already counted once when they were new, and so we don't do it again. So in other words, if someone sells a house that was built, let's say, in 1995. The house sells for $200,000. We would not include that sale in GDP. We would, however, include in the GDP the commission that was made by the real estate agent. But the house itself was already produced, so we would be double counting it if we counted it again. Final goods and services. Now, final means that that's the last stage of production. So we don't count the intermediate goods. A car bumper wouldn't be counted because we're counting the whole car after it's finished being produced. So you don't have intermediate goods being counted. Within the borders. So in other words, there are a lot of things that are produced in other countries that we wouldn't count in this country. But they were, essentially, they have a USA label on them, but they might have been made in China, Vietnam, Mexico, or in a combination of countries. So in other words, transnational and multinational companies would have a lot that was being made that would not be in our GDP. It might be in the GDP of some other country where it was made, but it won't be in ours. Another interesting thing about GDP. Have you ever sold heroin? Have you ever been a male prostitute?
No.
You should try it. Sparky. It is. You're cougar bait. You could sell like hotcakes. You see, these things are not counted because they're black market. And we don't count black market. And there's something that's interesting about it, because when we go into bad economic times, illegal activities tend to go up in their value as part of the economy. And when times are good, illegal activity tends to go down. So whereas in good economic times, you will work that incredibly great job at Walmart, but when times go bad and you can get only 20 hours a week as a greeter, suddenly there you are, male gigolo, doing wrongful things. But they feel right. Very right. Anyway, now, you see what is going on here is that when we measure booms and busts, the economic activity, by just GDP, what we're not seeing is that in the troughs, there is this underground market that's actually active. There's also people doing things for themselves. We don't count it when you make your own. You make good apple pies, but when times are good, you just go down to the bakery and buy them. But when times are bad, you make them yourself. So in other words, when you buy it from the bakery, it's counted in GDP, but when you make it yourself, it's not. So what that means is that there are activities going on, black market activities, homegrown activities, that tend to not be measured, that are part of our economic life. But then when times are good, illegal activities tend to decline, and so do homegrown activities, things people do for themselves. When you're making lots of money, you're not going to cook your own dinner. You're going to go out and have a good meal. But when times are bad, you'll fix your own meal. So in the good times, all that economic activity that you give to the restaurant is counted. But in bad times, all that activity that you do for yourself is not counted. So that's a little problem with GDP. And it's a big problem in some countries where black market activity tends to be very much a big part of the economy. So for example, in a country, war-torn country like Afghanistan, the GDP is wretched, but there is an enormous amount of economic activity going on through the opium market. It's essentially a vertical monopoly from the gates of the farm on through to the packing and the cutting for street dealing. It's all there, and we don't see it as part of the GDP of that country. So what do we do about it? We've got GDP. It's a blunt measure, and it gives us some idea of what's going on, but it doesn't tell us the whole story. But here's something interesting. Suppose that we have country A and country B, and we have the GDP and we have the population. Let's say that the GDP of country A is, in American dollars, $10 million. The GDP of country B is $1 million. Well, obviously, it looks like country A is a much larger economy, a more robust economy, 10 times as much, an order of magnitude. But let's say that the population of country A is 10 million people, and the population of country B is 100,000 people. Look what happens when we look, consider the per capita. In other words, the per head, the average GDP. Suddenly, this big country A economy has a dollar per person. But country B has $10 per person. Yeah.
How do you spell capita? Like per capita?
Per capita. That's Latin, okay. You know. It's great. Knowing Latin is important, especially at a singles bar. You speak in Latin, they'll think you're a priest. I don't know what the hell that does for you at the bar, but anyway, here you go. So you see, the per capita GDP captures something that the just blunt overall GDP doesn't. It's on average. So in other words, the United States looks like a big, big GDP. I mean, it's the biggest in the world. It's an 800-pound gorilla of a GDP. But when you look at it on a per capita basis, what would you suppose would be the richest country on a per capita basis? Got a stab at it?
Australia?
No, they're poor as dirt. Except for the ones who do movies, you know. Like Steve Irwin, well, not Steve Irwin, he's dead, but that guy who did the Down Under movie or whatever it was. Any other guess? Huh? Bingo. Luxembourg. Wait, where? Yeah, a little tiny kingdom in Europe where only filthy rich people live. There are other people who are there, but they are all servants. And when they're not needed, they are sent away. But the core population is small, and very rich. So you would find that on a per capita basis, what looks like the largest economy in the world, by far the United States, really is in a pack with other countries that have, on a per capita basis, on an average per person basis, pretty decent overall income. But per capita GDP is not the whole story. I just erased that. Okay, there was GDP, and then per capita GDP. Now we're going to go to the next one. What if we had a country that had $1 million and 100,000 citizens? Well, that's $10 per person. But suppose that one person had $999,999, one person, and the other 99,999 people had the other dollar. It's got a per capita GDP that's still $10 per person, but that average isn't telling the story at all. This is a country that has an enormous division in income between the rich and the poor. And that's where we get down to some more important measures, where we are beginning to look at not just overall wealth, not just average per person wealth, but looking at income distribution. Here's how we measure it. We start with this percent of population. And we divide it into tenths. Tenths of the population. In other words, this would be the lowest 10% of households. And we usually do it on a households basis. Lowest 10%. Lowest 20%, lowest 30%, 40%, 50%, 60%, let me mark this one off, 60%, 70%, 80%, 90%, and we go up to 100%. And on this, we will measure percent of income. Now, sometimes this graph measures percent of wealth. They're actually different things. Income is how much is flowing through the economy. Wealth is the stock of capital in the economy. But we'll do it on income. Now, obviously, 0% of the population has 0% of the income. And 100% of the population, and let me do this, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50% of the income, 60, 70, 80, 100%. Now, obviously, 100% of the population has 100% of the income. So ideally, in a perfectly equal income distribution, 10% of the household, the lowest 10% of the households would have 10% of the income, the lowest 20% of the households would have 20% of the income, et cetera, on up to 100% has 100%. So you would have a diagonal line would represent perfect income distribution equality. But that's not how it works anywhere in the world. Nowhere in the world does the economy lie on the diagonal. So you'll have countries where the lowest 10% of the population might have a paltry 1% of the income. The lowest 20% might have 5%. The lowest 30% might have 15%. So by the time you get up to the 90 percentile, you're suddenly seeing the wealthy having far in excess of their share on an average basis. And so what we have in real economies is what is called a Lorenz curve. The more it bows downward, the more unequal the income distribution. Again, the more it bows downward, the more unequal the distribution of income. Now, speaking from as someone who's actually done Lorenz curves, they are difficult to interpret because you'll have different Lorenz curves. Now, you'll see some Lorenz curves that are very tight. Socialist-type economies tend to have relatively what you might call, for lack of a better word, fair distribution of income. And then you'll have other economies that have heavy, heavy bowing. But when you collect the data, these bows can have different shapes. Some of them can be more bowed like this, and some of them can be more bowed like this. So sometimes you'll have these economies where everyone is dirt poor except for a few rich families. And then you'll have others where there's just a lower class population that is miserably poor, but there's a middle class and an upper class that are doing okay for themselves. So they have all kinds of different shapes along the way when you collect the real world data. What we like to do is try to turn graphs, which can be subject to a lot of argument and interpretation, into numbers. And so with this one, what we do is we measure the area between the real Lorenz curve and the ideal one. And we scale that from 0 to 1. And that area we call the Gini coefficient. The Gini coefficient. I'm going to show you something here. This will be the first thing that I show you tonight. But just to give you an idea, you would expect, well, of course, you're going to have these Gini coefficients the Gini coefficient will range between 0 and 1. 0 would be perfect income equality, income distribution equality. In other words, there's no area between the actual Lorenz curve and the ideal. And 1 would be like a theoretical, there's one person who has everything and everyone else has nothing. For lack of a better term, we can call that outrageous. I don't know. So you're, yeah, go ahead. You had a question? G-I-N-I, capital G-I-N-I. Now I'm going to turn off the light here so you can see some Gini coefficients. Now, the top of this chart, now this, I'm going to give you a recommendation. If you want data that's pretty interesting, go to the CIA World Factbook. The CIA collects tons of information, a lot of economic data, because economic information tends to point us to trouble spots in the world. So the CIA collects a lot of it. And here we're going to see Gini coefficients from around the world, starting from the worst countries to the best countries. Okay, you see those giant Gini coefficients, 63.2%, that's just madness. That's a huge Gini coefficient. So let's start down here at the bottom, and let's look at these countries. Sweden, in the CIA World Factbook, and of course the data is collected for different years, so they're not perfect. This isn't a perfect picture, but it's as good as we can get. You'll see Sweden has the lowest Gini, in other words, the closest to a diagonal line. Very narrow Lorenz curve. And it's because it's socialist. You tax the hell out of everyone and then give the money back to everyone equally or something like that. Slovenia, Montenegro, Hungary, Denmark. You can see all these countries, a lot of them in Europe. Everyone's miserable in Romania. Yeah, pretty cool.
Where's the U.S.?
Oh, my. What are you griping about? Where? Surely, oh, it's got to be down here someplace, you know. Okay, now we're in trouble. We passed Latvia. We've passed Laos and Indonesia, Vietnam. Wait, Israel? Serbia? Cambodia? Okay, I must have left the United States out of here some way. Turkmenistan? Nicaragua? Have you seen Nicaragua lately? Kenya? Iran? Oh, thank God. 41st worst, according to our CIA economic data munchers. That's bad. Folks, that is an unpleasant thing to look at when you see that we have a very unequal distribution of income, and it is getting worse by the year. That is something that is notable. And you can have the right-wing economists and the conservative economists justify it, well, we're a capitalist country. You rise or fall based on, you know, who you are and what you can do and whether you're lazy or ambitious. It's just the way we are. Well, congratulations. We are in the neighborhood of countries like Bulgaria and Cameroon and Iran. Something might tell you, well, to put it in dignified academic terms, that ain't right. That just ain't right. And as I said, there's another point that's made here. The CIA does not collect this data just to collect data. It collects it because economic difficulty is one of the prescriptors of social unrest, and social unrest is the precursor of revolt and revolution across the world and across time. As long as you keep people fat and fed, they'll put up with whatever the government does. But when the government can no longer do that
And all it does is coddle a small, narrow sector of the population. Sooner or later, the flashpoint happens. Remember how I told you? Everyone just kind of sat back through all of the deprivations in our American history. But somewhere along the line, if it gets too bad, all it takes is one last incident for something terrible to happen. And that is what we are seeing here. That is why our government has militarized our police. That is why our government is worried about watching us, is because of the economic reality. As Karl Marx would have put it, the dialectic materiality of economic life is a motivator. That's why we try to make countries economically prosperous. That's been one of the goals of the United States over the past since World War II. Make life better in countries, and that way they'll stay in our camp and they won't have a population that rises up and causes trouble. But there we are. Well, let's have a look at the rest of our neighbors. Lesotho. Oh, you know, that's interesting. Where is Canada in this? Oh, great. Moose hunters are better than us. There it is. That's a problem. Don't get me wrong. I'm not calling you to revolution. For God's sake, you guys would get shot before you even got out the door. Knock it off. You wouldn't even look good in a red beret. But at the same time, this is why it is not wise to just take that, well, economic opportunity is there for all those who want it, and if you want to be rich, you can be rich through hard work, through the meritocratic process. It has its consequences when we let it go as far as we have in our current age. In your time, this has come about. So let me go and knock off with that for a minute here. Oh, bright lights. Funny, the stars are out tonight. Much better, stronger. Okay, let me, good. Okay, I'm going to take that off the board here. Look. Money can't buy happiness. It can buy wine, which is almost as good, but you know. But the thing is that money isn't the only measure of prosperity. You can be happy and not have an enormous income. You can be a nation of people, and there are measures that are other than gross domestic product, gross. You can even have countries where there are just a few families that have most of the wealth, but the people are still happy in those countries. And the people, and we consider those countries to be prosperous in one way or another. Understand then that there are other measures besides these technical measures that sound so economic. And what I want to do is I want to give you some of the other measures that aren't exactly economics measures, but they matter to the economist who wants a broad picture of economic prosperity. We have simple measures. Simple measures are out there. Infant mortality rate. Per number of live births. In other words, how many babies die before they are, let's say, 6 months old? That is not exactly an economic measure, but it has enormous economic and social impact. The fact of the matter is that the United States has a high infant mortality rate compared to most countries in the world. I published an article about 4 years ago about this. We are lower on our infant mortality rate, I'm sorry, is higher than Cuba's infant mortality rate. Our infant mortality rate is rather surprisingly high. Live births, babies who die. Now, the argument came back. I had a sociologist, conservative sociologist, say to me, well, you're wrong. What we're seeing is the effect of premature births. We are able to keep preemies alive, so we have a naturally higher infant mortality rate because a lot of those preemies do die. And I went through this research. No. The premature infant survival phenomenon is happening all over the world. We don't know exactly why that is, but preemies are being born in higher numbers all over the world, not just in the United States. So they are not skewing the infant mortality rate in this country. Our babies are just dying at a higher rate than countries all over the world. European Union, those countries have very low infant mortality rates. Japan, low infant mortality rate. Countries like Israel, low infant mortality rate. South Korea, lower infant mortality rate. We have a lot of our live babies die, a lot more than most countries. Now, there's another one, too, that is related to this. Live birth rate. In other words, how many babies per 100,000 women or 100,000 people are being born? The more babies that are being born, it's a mixed bag. If you don't have a good birth rate, your population is not going to grow sufficiently quickly to replace your aging and dying population. However, we know that a birth rate that is too high is a sign of bad economic conditions. Specifically, if women are having large numbers of babies, that means that the women do not have economic opportunities outside of their homes. So they just have babies, because why would you not have babies if you can't get a job? But if you are going to make, let's say, $250,000 a year, do you have time for six kids? No, most women won't. So we know that women rising in their economic opportunities are going to have fewer babies, and we hope take care of the ones that they have better. That's one of the problems, but there's another problem too. This isn't just a human problem. This happens all through the animal kingdom. Higher infant mortality rates and higher live birth rates are correlated. The higher the infant mortality rate, the higher the birth rate. It's called dead baby replacement. We see it in the animal kingdom, where there are species of animals that are having large numbers of their young die. They just naturally produce more so that they have a few survivors. And again, it has a grim name. It's called dead baby replacement. We see it in everything from goldfish to deer to apes to humans. So if we want to bring down the live birth rate, two things. One is bring down the infant mortality rate. Second thing is make the women more an equal part of the economy so that they can have other kinds of opportunities. Okay, let's go on to another one. Life expectancy. This is a bad one. The longer we see people living, the better. Women live longer than men, which is okay with me because I can die and I don't have to hear it anymore. But look, calm down, boy. They could hurt you here. Okay, but there's a problem with that. Living longer means living more expensive. To extend life a few more years in the senior years is extraordinarily costly. Medicines, surgeries, procedures, therapy, treatment. In fact, it was a lot better when you would die after your third kid at 18. You know why? Because you wouldn't live long enough to get breast cancer. We never saw it because women didn't live long enough to have that disease. You would have probably died before you had heart disease and atherosclerosis that we would have to treat. you would have died before we would have had to pay health insurance premiums for your Viagra. You would have been dead, and so you wouldn't. Rigor mortis would have set in, so you didn't need Viagra. That went right over you guys.
I heard.
The hell with you! I'm not even going to try to. God. Okay, here we go. So that's a mixed bag. Societies have dealt with things like this in the past, you know. People were not allowed to live too long. Among the Inuits, for example, at a certain age, a person would leave the community and go out and die in a quiet place where the ancestors had died. It kept the population from aging too much, and it kept the people from having to take care of these very old people. Let's try some other ones. Literacy rate. This is highly controversial. We would assume that people who are more literate, a population that is more literate, is better. Perhaps healthier. They can read about what to do. They can read about history and understand processes. They can be more informed about politics and choose better leaders. Unfortunately, the data on this is actually kind of mixed. India has a very low literacy rate, but it has a very healthy democracy. We have a country like the United States, which has a high literacy rate. Don't look at Facebook or you'll swear it's not true. But we choose rather bad leaders. Let's try some other ones. Age of first sexual encounter by females. Sit, boy. The old joke was that in the old days, the age of consent for a girl was the first time she was left alone with her brothers. Now, moving on from that, 18 years old, 21 years old, the problem is that the lower the age of first sexual encounter, probably the lower the age of first birth or first pregnancy. That's a bad sign because the earlier you get saddled with kids, the less your economic opportunities are going to be. So as this age of sexual activity, maturity, lowers, the more danger that puts that subpopulation of people in. Infectious disease rates. This is indicative of several issues. The simplest one is just access to clean water and toilets. That's part of this, but it's not the whole story at all. It also has to do with the access to vaccines, distribution, acceptance of vaccines, and all that. And we're sliding backward in this country. As people are saying, I ain't going to have no vaccine in my kids, we're sliding backwards. You got places in Africa where they would love to have vaccines so their kids don't die. And here we are. Yeah, I heard that's a government control thing that they're putting in them kids. Bull crap. Anyway, but there's another one, too, about infectious disease. Back in my time, before you were born, AIDS was coming on the scene, acquired immune deficiency syndrome. The first name for it, before they changed the name to AIDS, was the gay disease. Because it's obviously a homosexual's disease, isn't it? No, it's not. If you look around the world at the pockets of AIDS infection, what you will see is not pockets of homosexuality. You'll see pockets of poverty. You'll see pockets of ethnic suppression. You'll see pockets of miserable poverty. You look in Thailand. Who has AIDS in Thailand? The little brown girls. Because they're from the impoverished regions of that country. And so they're the ones who get exposed to it. You look in Africa. It's the tribes who are under the thumb of dominant tribes, the remnants of colonialism. You look around the world, infectious disease rates tend to track suppression of rights, human rights and civil rights, around the world. So guess what? Homosexuals are a traditionally suppressed population. Prostitutes are a tradition, sex workers are a traditionally suppressed population, subpopulation. So guess what? You see the AIDS showing up in those communities in this country. In other countries, you'll see other populations that are under assault as far as civil rights and human rights go. It is not as simple as, well, it's just a gay disease. It isn't. And neither are things like tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is showing up in this country again. I didn't think I would see that in my lifetime. Where is it showing up? Among homeless men. Again, a subpopulation that is suppressed as far as its rights, its opportunities, and its hope for the future. If you don't have hope, you're going to take a lot more risks than if you have hope. That's the reality of it. Infectious disease rates. That's another one that's kind of out there on the horizon, too. And there are other ones, too, that are important for you to know about. I want to bring up one last one for you in this section of the, in this hour. This has to do with something that we are all too familiar with, and I am quite familiar with because I was a soldier. It has to do with the reality of what is happening around the world as far as war goes, strife. Whenever you have a situation where there is a war going on, you are going to have not just combatants being killed, but you're also going to have civilians being killed. And more important than that, you're going to have children being killed. But you're also going to have something else that has enormous future political and economic impact happening. You're going to have the phenomena of misery among the children. It doesn't take just war itself. Poverty in and of itself breeds poverty. This is a child in a massive junkyard digging for stuff along with the scavenger birds. Where is his economic prosperity? And where is his hope for the future? I will grow up to find bigger trash places to sift through. That means that it's what we call the cycle of poverty. The cycle of economic unrest begins every generation that has to live like this and live in starvation. The kids who have to watch their brothers and sisters die, do you think they have any hope whatsoever of an economically bright future? All they hope for is that they don't have to be carried by their crying mother to a place where they can dispose of it because she's too weak to dig the grave herself, of course. And you have this miserable situation where some effete photographer stands there and photographs a child dying while the animal, while the bird waits. Yes, he did. Congratulations. The kid died first. You see, that's what we get when we are the observers looking down. Oh, tisk, tisk, isn't this a bad situation? Well, damn it, we ought to do something about it. Well, what we do about it, we make more war. We terrify the children who survive, and we make them aware of what they are in that world. Those, by the way, are Afghanistan kids. Oops, we missed. That was our fighter jet. That's what those kids have to look forward to, death or poverty. And their parents, what are their parents going to do? Except carry the injured and the wounded and the dead. But know this about it. Those kids aren't stupid. They learn their lessons. They learn their lessons from what we show them. Those weapons, those kids, those are Palestinian kids. You think they're going to solve this problem by bombing Gaza again? No, they're teaching the kids how to do it, how to be angry, how to grow up, not to become IT professionals, not to become doctors, but to become soldiers in the next war. And I would caution you as we go through this, that whatsoever we have done to these, the least of our children, that we have done not just to our gods, but to our future. You remember that. The next time you say tisk tisk, they should get their act together. That little girl, she's got her act together. She knows what she's going to do. Firing shrapnel at the corner of 5th and Main, well, who could have expected that? Well, you know better than that when it happens again in your lifetimes. Take a break. This is going to be on your test. Look at that, a table. See, I don't even make you calculate anything on the table. It's right there for you. Now, can you tell me, just looking at this right off the bat, and you're trying to write fast, I hear smoke coming off pencils and pen. Okay. Is this a monopoly or a company in perfect competition? Why? What's the demand curve look like? Where do you see the demand curve? The first two columns are a demand curve. Is that demand curve flat or is it downward sloping? And that means monopolies face the full downward sloping demand curve of the industry. So this company is looking at a full, is a monopoly because it sees a whole demand curve. Now, could you tell me right off the top of your noggin how many units this monopoly should produce? And what price it should charge for those that it makes?
11, 29,
10 for 30. Yeah. Well, yeah, because you see that that's the last place where the marginal revenue is still larger than the marginal cost. And also, you see, that's where the profit peaks out. Now, there's one other thing. If this were a pile of companies in perfect competition, where how much would the industry produce and what price would it charge? Because that's the last place where the price is still above the marginal cost. So that would be the difference in this case between these two companies. If this between these two industries. Looking at this as a monopoly, this monopoly will produce less and charge a higher price. If this is in perfect competition, a bunch of companies, then they will produce, the whole industry will, where the price, which is the marginal revenue on a flat demand curve, is the last place above the marginal cost, which is the supply curve. Okay, that's enough of that. Okay, now, I am going to show you on the test, and I did this. You saw that on the quiz, too. That graph where I'm going to show you a monopoly and all that kind of stuff. And say, all right, quantity, got your demand curve, your marginal revenue curve, and then there's your supply curve. I'm going to say, all right, where does the output of a monopolist land? And it's always, always where marginal costs and marginal revenue come together. Or the last place, if it's like on a half line, is the last place where marginal revenue is above marginal cost. So in other words, the first thing you do is find where marginal revenue and marginal costs come together. That's your monopoly output level. And again, don't let me bluff you because I'll try to. I'll give you the multiple choice answer that's wrong as one of the possibilities. Don't go over to here. There's nothing there to see. This is not the price you're looking for. The price is what the market will bear for that output level. Price of the monopolist. All you have to do is be able to identify the monopoly output level and the monopoly price. I'll probably also ask you to tell me what the perfect competition output level and price is. That's just where supply and demand come together, the old gospel. Yeah, that's just the old equilibrium, yes. So if you know how to do this, you've got some major heavies on the test.
Did you say that picture was going to be on?
It'll be with a grid so you can read it much better, okay? Because you remember that last one was just kind of like a blank and a couple of lines across. This is an actual full grid on the test. But yeah, it'll look just like that, except you'll be able to read it really well, provided the copier works well. Now, there's one other thing here, too. Make sure that you know about these two areas. Don't forget to know about that. Yeah, producer surplus and consumer surplus. And know that the monopoly shrinks the consumer surplus, and the monopoly also expands the producer surplus, but it leaves behind this whole area here that used to be part, if it were in perfect competition, this would be part of it. Consumer surplus and producer surplus is lost. What do we call that? Deadweight loss. Know that. Deadweight loss. So now, let's make sure that we have some other terminology down. Any output level and associated price below A is called shutdown. Company can't even pay its variable cost. It's not in business. Any place between A and B is short-run survival. They can pay the cost of making the units, but they can't quite cover all of their cost per unit. And above B is economic profit. Now, there are two kinds of economic profit. What are the two kinds? Economic rent and economic quasi-rent. What's the difference?
Whether it's long-term or not.
That's right. Now, with economic rent, it'll stay. But if it's just a company that's making extra gravy, then there's going to be companies that are going to come in and compete because there's extra profit to be made, which will cause the supply curve of the industry to shift out, push the price back down. So those profits will disappear over time. And there have been many examples of that. A company comes in with some new product, and it makes extra money for a while, but then all of a sudden, every company floods in, and then the profit goes away. It was like early in the life of PCs, personal computers. There was IBM, and you had some other ones there as well, in the early days, but IBM pretty much was the name of the game. But as soon as it was obvious that there was lots and lots of money to be made in this, well, then you had all these other companies start pouring in, prices came collapsing down, so the economic profit turned out to be just quasi-rent, not full rent.
So the quasi-rent is the overtime.
It gets taken away.
Okay.
by competitive entry. And the only way that can be kept from happening, and it's not even very successful, is with like patents and trademarks keeping your competitors out. But even at that, I mean, the barbarians are going to try to overrun your gates with knockoffs and all of that. Interestingly enough, sometimes you'll see patents and trademarks really work well, and other times it's just like all of a sudden there's just a whole pile of knockoffs on the market. Like, for example, like these infomercial products, some of them, you'll see there won't be another one like that. That's just the only brand there is. And then other ones, you'll just see knockoffs flying off, showing up really fast on them. One that's weird, I don't know why there haven't been knockoffs on it. Apparently, its patents are pretty strong, are those stupid shake weights. I mean, those things are creepy. But and very popular too, very successful. God knows why. Okay, now going back through, let's grind. I'm going to take you through the meat grinder one last time. Okay. Now let's talk about different industries. If I were to say advertising, what industry structure? Industry structure. Monopolistic competition. What are they trying to do with advertising? What's the term? The advertising is to the end of creating product
differentiation.
Bingo. That means that this is a kind of product that has hooks. Things that can be used to make people think that the product is different from products that are just like it. Whether or not they are doesn't matter. All we need is for people to believe that they are. That's why belief is one of the most dangerous things in the world. Okay, now, if I were to tell you ferocious competition, fierce competition, say it.
Perfect
competition, but also, that's right. Both of those have ferocious competition. I mean, if you're a farmer, you got to be out there every day because there are more than a million other farmers competing with you. In monopolistic competition, everyone's trying to get the better of you to get market share on you, to gain market share points at your expense. Strategic pricing.
Oligopoly.
Strategic anything is an oligopoly. Share of the market. Probably a monopoly. Probably. I mean, you know, you talk about, you like to look at it. What's the threshold for essentially what is an uncompetitive market as far as HHI is concerned? Do you remember the number? No? Completely uncompetitive is 1,800. Between 1,000 and 1,800, it is not a competitive market, but the FTC is pretty much, below 1,000, it's quite competitive. So if you're starting your own business, think about HHI. Although there are companies, even in industries with high HHIs, there are some theoreticians and practitioners of starting businesses who say that's actually one of the places where you might want to go to start a business, is where the HHI is very high. Why would that be? There's two different scenarios. What does Google do if you're a tiny little company and you're really good at what you do? That's right, and you become a millionaire overnight. But what else could happen?
You could be a rising star. You could be something different, something that's like
You could niche market out. You could do a niche market. That's why you have these successful companies that can live in a world with Coke and Pepsi. They niche out a market, and they get their own little fan club. Energy drinks turned into a huge thing. But it doesn't have to be energy drinks. You have Sobe. You have Life Water. You have all these little companies out there that just niche out, and they can live like rats in the field of the dinosaurs because the dinosaurs are too big to see them and stomp on them. Okay.
Now you can't tell me that Coke and Pepsi haven't tried to buy Monster or like Rockstar or any of those energy drinks.
No, they haven't. They've tried a few times themselves, but these are strategic companies. These are oligopolies. They understand markets. And they have seen too many companies that tried to get into something where they didn't have a specialty. You see, they play the long game. Do you drink energy drinks?
I do.
Are you going to drink them when you're 50?
Probably not.
No, because you'll twitch off. You'll drink it, and then you'll be on the ground kicking your hind leg around. They're strategic. Let the kids have their drinks. Let them have their little fan clubs with Monster. Because all we have to do is make sure that we get the propaganda out that they're dangerous and we'll make those companies go away. We'll make people afraid of those drinks. But while they're still loving them, well, it doesn't matter because they'll always come back home to Daddy. They're prodigal sons. Everyone is. They'll come home to Coke and Pepsi eventually. So why should we waste money on something that they'll leave when they grow up? Right? Strategic thinkers. Remember that. They don't have to worry about flashing the pan and all that. Remember what I told you about the difference between money and power? If you have a choice, you choose power. Because money is just the McMansion in Sarasota. Power is the old stone building that lasts the ages. The McMansion can burn down, and you can make sure that it does. The stone building can't be burned down. Okay, here we go. Next one. I'm glad I saw this. Okay. Throw a year out that would be pro-labor. Just throw a year out for me. Any year that would have been in American history.
1950.
No. By 1950, McCarthy was around. By 1950, the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act had been passed. By 1950, you were reaching the peak of union activity, which meant that you were probably losing your mojo. Your steam was going away. Try another year.
46.
Oh, nice going. Yeah, okay. Give me a central year. Someone give him a cookie and some duct tape for his mouth. No, that, you know, labor was all. Good. Good. Give her a cookie. White chocolate. Never mind that dark chocolate. That just gives me the wind. Okay.
Wait a minute, goddamn.
Of course, the oatmeal cookies are not good either. Okay, here we go. Pro-labor, anti-labor. 1910. Anti. It was still when the government was sending in troops. Pro-labor, anti-labor. 1916. Pro, because that was during Wilson, Woodrow Wilson. He told the Fed, he said, we're not going to send federal troops to knock down protesters, striking workers and all that. So there was a little window there in 1914 to 1918 when the government backed off its anti-labor, pro-business tilt. But once Wilson was out of office, you had a string of three pro-business presidents, one right after the other after the other. I didn't ask you to remember all three, but do you know the three presidents that right before Franklin Roosevelt, between Wilson and Roosevelt, you know who the three presidents were? Who?
Harding?
And Hoover. Gotcha, Hoover. That was the easiest one. Yeah. Okay. So just I'm going to throw out little time periods, and I'm going to say which one of these time periods would have been pro-labor? And only one of them will be a time period. Just remember the time period of Wilson, 1914 to 1918, and Roosevelt, which was really from 1932, late 32, on through to 1946. Those two periods in American history were pro-labor. Yeah. Now, who was the president when the riots happened in New York, the immigrant worker riots happened in New York? Well, there have been many of those. But who was the first president who dealt with rioting immigrant workers in New York City? And his troops killed a number of them during the riot. You remember who it was? Honest Abe Lincoln, Mr. Lincoln's troops. The immigrants got sick of all the rich people getting their kids out of fighting the war when all the immigrants' poor kids were getting slaughtered. And so they rioted in New York, and Lincoln's troops came in and shot them in the street. By the hundreds, they were shot. Many died. Okay. I think I've told you almost everything on this test. Okay. I'm going to give you a description. Just make sure that you can do this. I wear a safety helmet when I ride my bicycle. Now, people say that I'm a real jerk when I weave in and out of traffic and I cut between cars and I go right through stop signs and things like that. What is it called that I have all this protective gear on and it makes me behave like an asshole? Is it morale hazard or moral hazard? You're right. It is probably morale. I won't distinguish between them on the test. Don't get me wrong. It'll all be moral hazard. But in this case, it would probably be, I just feel like I'm Superman. It's not that I'm consciously saying, well, I'm better protected, so I'm going to be a jerk. It's just that I don't have to worry as much about those kinds of things. And that's one of that. And that, interestingly enough, applies. Oddly enough, one of the things that I'll see in one of my upper level finance class, or not even upper level, but an intermediate level finance class, is the students who will just have a fit. Those ones who are in the highest fraternity, best fraternity, they've got 4 points, and they start defecating their diapers because they're going to get a B in my class, or maybe even a C. And they'll have their dads call me, they'll visit with the dean about the problems that they've had with me. What's going on with them? It's moral hazard. They've never had to be afraid. Their genius, their native thinking and skills at test taking have always gotten them through. So they just naturally take the risk of not studying very much because they've always gotten the right answers. They always just know the teachers are pushovers, the tests are predictable and all that. And suddenly, when they're not, they start having a problem. That's moral. That's actually a morale hazard. They just don't worry about studying. And then the students who just struggle, study hard, they get the A's in classes of mine. That's a classic morale hazard. It's right there.
So morale hazard and moral hazard. Moral hazard with the Superman, and moral hazard is the
asshole. Yeah, sort of. I guess you could put it that way. I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
What the hell? Yeah, I guess. Okay, do you have questions for me on this test? Any questions? Can you cheat? Yes. But before the test, not during the test. Well, that's all I have for you. I thank you.